Blog Talk Radio.
Oh, that's right. Thanks for tuning in. This is Sonic Audio, and guess what? This is Taino. Taino Radio. Radio Taino. ¿Cómo está todo el mundo? Güey. Right here live in New York City, Lenny Lenape territory. And guess who I have with me in this? The return by popular demand. The DNA show. I have our Juanita from the mountains of Arayeke, Yucayek. We have Inaru Obería. What's up?
Hey, Sanakori.
Oh, man, we're back. 48 hours later. No, 72 hours later, we're back from the Spooky Lou show, huh?
Oh, that's right.
Hey, man, front and center. This is great. You know, popular demand. It's been a while since we had the DNA show. As they say in Spanish, I think they say N-A-D-A. So we're back, man. What's that?
I believe it's A-D-N-A.
Oh, I see. There you go. More reverse. Wow. A-D-N-A. Do you know why it's like reversed like that, or I guess it's just Spanish, right?
Yeah, I think it's just a translation for it.
Yeah, man. I know the high middle age Spanish language a little backward, you know, but wait a minute, this is not the Spooky Lou show. Wait a minute, this. Calm, see, the studio, once again, it's still, I have smudged the place, and it's still a little off. I'm sorry, man.
Oh, wait,
sorry, your listeners. What's that?
I said it's still going loopy.
It's in our DNA, man, that we have to bring up the paranormal stuff every day. It's always a good day to be paranormal, right?
Exactly. Every day is a good day to be spooky.
That's right. Well, check it out. Popular demand, the DNA show. If anyone wants to call in, this is the number 9792. That's 515-602-9792. Anyone who wants to call in, and hey, there we go, the DNA show. Tell us what's going on in Arubaria.
Well, like you've said, we've had a good amount of requests for the DNA show to come back. And we've had a lot of, I know at least me personally, I've had a lot of people who have been looking to join Arayeke. And one of their biggest questions is always, how does DNA play a role in my enrollment? And
interesting.
We have so many questions that keep on popping up regarding features, characteristics, percentages, breaking the ideas and the stereotypes of the requirements for blood quantum. And then some people not even knowing that, you know, the idea of having a certain percentage to prove indigenous identity is blood quantum. So then when they hear that phrase, they ask for more information. What is blood quantum? Where did it come from? Why do we use it? why do the North American and the South American tribes use it occasionally? Why does North America rely on it so much? And then we come into the question of genealogy and relatives and generational links. And, you know, it's become a consistent idea where people are really trying to get to know themselves through the genetic markers and their chromosomes that make them them and what makes them different from, you know, their relatives. Some people have siblings that look completely, you know, identical to them, and some people have siblings that look completely opposite of them, and they want to know why. Why is it that I came out with light eyes and light hair and light skin, and my siblings came out, you know, more brown-skinned, brown eyes, brown hair? Why do I look like I'm the milkman's kid? So
there you go.
Hopefully with this new season of the DNA show with Taino Radio, we can start to really delve into the concerns and the ideas and the questions that everybody has in regards to identifying themselves as Taino people without the stigma, without the falsehoods that have been so widely used in a general sense of identification and self-identification of indigenous identity, and then also helping to break that stigma. You know, we want to make sure that you understand, you know, the listeners understand, the people who call in, we want to make sure that they understand that indigenous identity is not just having a specific percentage, you know, that there is an idea of that one drop rule, that you have a drop, that's part of you, you know. And we see it a lot in indigenous communities that don't use blood quantum. They do. They believe that that one drop rule applies. If you have it in you, if you can honor it, then that's what you are, you know. So hopefully we can touch on all of these things and help provide people with clarity and understanding and, you know, really be able to teach through our own experiences and get a few people to call in live to go over maybe their DNA results or their very specific questions as far as indigenous identity, that proclamation, and even genealogy, their own familial genealogy, if those are things that they need assistance with.
Stephanie, are you there? Creepy Steph, are you there?
I'm here.
Guess what happened? Were you on the air? Were you remaining on the air?
Yes, yeah, I was still on air.
All right. Okay. This is not Monday. This is not the Spooky Lou show. I don't understand.
Oh, man.
So, for all you listeners out there, this is crazy. We went off the air. So, I think it's a safe bet that we got some spirit DNA in the studio, which is cool. Did you hear the music? Did it come on?
Yes, the music came on.
Well, what I was saying was, and I guess no one heard me, when I was saying that, this is too much, that when my 23andMe profile was updated last year, it came out that I had like a whole bunch of Mongolian DNA. So I was really happy about that because I love Asian cultures. This is the time I met Bruce Lee in TV, and I love the Asian culture. I'm always in Chinatown, and I was very excited about that. So I played that song, The Wolf Totem, The Who Band. What do you think about that?
It was really interesting. When I first started to, like, when I first started to play, I thought it was throat singing, like Inuit singing. But then, you know, it got a little bit further in, and I was like, oh, yeah, no, definitely not Inuit.
Yeah, it's definitely throat singing, but yeah, see? They
yeah,
do the same thing, the Mongolians.
Yeah, very, very similar. The Inuit, they use more breath, more breathing sound compared to the Tibetan and Mongolians that use that that pure throat sound.
Yeah, so I was saying that, you know, I was very excited. You know what's cool? My mother never raised me. I never was raised by my mom or my dad. And then when we started talking, one thing that we realized that we had something in common through the years is my mom loves Chinatown. So even before I told her that we had, you know, indigenous DNA and all that, I said, guess what? We got Asian DNA. And she was real happy about that. So
okay.
I'm telling you, son, about the Asian, about the Asian influence, right?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely understand. I'm part Asian. My father's side is the family.
Right.
I'm only Spaniel from my mom's side. So my father's side is completely different. I am Polynesian and Chinese and Trinidadian from my dad's side. So my great-grandfather is directly from China, from Guangzhou, the Guangdong district of southern China. So I've always had that connection. It's how I learned, or it's why I learned Mandarin. And then as I grew up, I found out I learned Mandarin for absolutely no good reason, because that's not what we spoke.
That is crazy, man. You learned a whole language. You know, it wasn't part of your heritage.
I learned a whole language just to find out that we're supposed to speak, or that they speak Cantonese and Guangzhou. So, you live and you learn.
The good news is you can speak Mandarin.
Yeah, that definitely is. It's been helpful. I don't get to do it as often as I would like, but you know, it's nice to break out every once in a while. So, yeah, now I'm learning Burikiniki instead.
That's wonderful. You know, I don't know if you saw this online, but it comes up many times when I'm online. You know how Google always knows what you're up to. And sent me, right? Google, right? They know exactly what you're up to. And they sent me a link. It just popped up in one of my searches. And it was an elder from Montana. I want to say the Northern Cheyenne Reservation he's from. Or the Crow. And now I don't remember. But it was a commercial advertising the DNA from... Oh, now I forget the company. It's the latest one that came out. It starts with a C. C something, something, something.
See, I need to do my research. But I remember. Yeah. Huh?
I had no idea.
Yeah, and they're cheaper than most of the companies. And what happened was. Yeah, it's real cheap. And I'm scared to look it up right now because I'm afraid my phones are going to go dead. So here's the thing. In this commercial, this native guy is saying that, you know, he and his brother have been into the genealogy, where they're from, but they wanted to go way back. So they went to the libraries and they went back generations, way back, like 6-7 generations to the time of the American expansion, whatever. And then that's it, no more, you know. So what happened was they took a DNA test. And the brother who brought it to the attention to the other brother who was part of his commercial, he died. So he never got to see his results. So when he got the results in the commercial, he's saying that the oldest DNA he had was from Polynesia. And these Polynesians migrated to Peru. And these Peruvian natives spread out, all these indigenous people that landed in Peru from Polynesia, they spread out through South America and eventually they went north. And that was in his DNA profile. The oldest indigenous DNA was from Polynesia that went to Peru. Yeah. So... And this is commercial, and I guess he's advertising his company that helped him out with this, you know. But they're saying, like, don't believe the other companies. This is the truth kind of thing, you know. But it's interesting that out of all of them, they're saying that Polynesia, you know. So, and I know I know in my jet match, the Polynesian DNA is connected with the Brazilian natives. Couple of kit numbers in there.
Oh wow!
So I thought of that right away. I said, wait, we have evidence of Polynesia in Brazil because it's in Jet Match, and I match with those people, you know. So I'm like, oh damn! And I remember, but check this out: Vine Deloria Jr., the famous anthropologist and theologian, the one that wrote "God Is Red." He went to South America and worked his way up to North America, as far as Canada. So he started from Chile all the way up to Canada, right? Tracing the migration route. Because his tradition, Lakota, they said that the migration was from the south. So he followed the migration stories, the ancient stories. And he followed all the way up to Canada. So he believes migration starts from the south. So I'm just wondering, if this whole Polynesian connection, what do you think about that?
I mean, it's definitely possible. I know that when I looked up information regarding, I think Cryogenics is the ad that you saw. Shout out to
yes, that's it. That's
Lisa
the one.
Suarez, who just sent me that message.
who's sending you the message?
Yeah,
someone sending you a message?
Yeah, Lisa Suarez. It sounds like she's listening.
That's
so,
the
hey,
one.
Lisa.
That's the company.
Yeah. But yeah, so when I started to look into like mtDNA, what I saw was that they have this this first set of DNA is allegedly a woman from Africa. And then from Africa, they migrated, or she migrated, or her lineage migrates out to Southern Asia. And then from Southern Asia, that's where it starts to branch out to all these other areas. So I don't think it's improbable that Polynesian DNA would have traveled from everywhere, anywhere else. You know what I mean? Definitely, I mean, like I said, when I got my DNA information, I found out that I had this a bit of Polynesian in me solely because we did my grandfather. And he had, I wish I remembered what the region was from ancestry. But there's a region, and they identified it as only found in men of the Polynesian, of Polynesian descent. So that trait, those characteristics were carried through solely through his male line. So I wouldn't have seen it in mine in any capacity. But I know through history and, you know, researching migration patterns that Polynesian people have, you know, these advanced means of transportation, or had these advanced means of transportation. And they did go all over the place. You know, they came to the Americas. So there's really no doubt in my mind that they would have made it to Central America and South America to not only trade, but to explore and to see what was around them. I mean, our indigenous people, all indigenous people, were extremely resourceful and very, very far ahead of their time. So I definitely think it's possible.
You know, I remember I read this book in the 90s, and it's a book that I kept rereading because I found it intriguing. The person who wrote it on purpose wrote the original name of his people. And I only remember the end, Ojibwe, which is the Ojibwe people. But the original name is, like, really long. Nijiwewa, something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, I can't pronounce it. I'm sorry,
right.
I can't pronounce Ojibwe's original name.
Right.
I do know a few Ojibwe people up in Canada, but not for the life of me, I can't say it.
Right. So he's in the book. He coins the phrase, "We have a right to exist." You know, he coins that phrase in his book, "We have a right to exist." And I remember him saying that when people went to, they're not federally recognized, they're not state recognized, they never wanted to be recognized. They're under the radar, this tribe, but they're very, have a lot of ancient practices. And when I remember him saying that, someone have visited him and they said they went to Tibet, right? And they say, "Yo, you got to go to Tibet, because in Tibet they have the same headdress you guys wear." So this man, I believe he was a PhD. He was a PhD scholar. He go for his people. So he goes to Tibet, and the same exact headdress that Tibetans have in their temple that his tribe has. So then he researched it, and he says, yep, he said in the oral traditions of his people, they did migrate west. They did migrate west, and they never came back, some of the people. So he was saying that the Tibetan people are descendants of his people. And the proof is that headdress.
Right.
So there's a native people saying, "Hey, we migrated west instead of the other way around, east to west, or west to east."
Mm-hmm.
What do you think about that one? I wish I had the book, man. I lost track of it.
I mean, I definitely think, like I said, I think it's probable, considering so many of our indigenous people were sea-bearing people, you know, they traveled and they traded, and, you know, they were very reliant on the waters. It's definitely possible. I don't see that not being the case. I mean, look at the alleged migration patterns between what we consider to be the Mayans, the Aztecs, the Olmecs, to the Caribs. You know,
okay, check
so,
it out. Yeah, yeah. I found the book. It was written by Yop Eke Niwe, YUB-E-K-E-N-Y-N-I-E-W, and it's called "We Have a Right to Exist." a translation of Aboriginal Indigenous thought, the first book ever published from Anishinaabe perspective. And it's a beautiful book. You can get it online. And it talks about, yeah, that they migrated west. So, I don't know. I would love to get a hold of their DNA, right?
Right.
Compare it to
I'd
the Tibetans.
That.
And then we compare it to the, we can compare it to the Tibetans, right?
Exactly.
Are you there?
It's
can you hear me?
The connections in general. Yeah, can you hear me, Sanakwari?
Yeah, something went wrong with my studio again. Spooky Lou, can you please leave the room? All right, we're back. Where's that intern? I keep asking for the intern. Where is it?
Same intern. I think you need a new one.
I need a new one, man. And I don't need a ghost. It's a ghost intern. I don't get it.
Oh, man. See, that's what happens when we talk about aliens too much.
I'm telling you, man. But you know, going forward, man, can you just, you know, there's a lot of stuff's going to happen in the DNA show. I mean, we'll get some people on that out west that can share their oral traditions of migration, you know, and match that with
DNA.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's going to be extremely enlightening, the series that we're going to be building with literally having, you know, people come on and ask specific questions. You know, the last season that we had of the DNA show, we did have some callers come in and they were provided clarity and given direction in regards to their, you know, identity and understanding it and feeling prideful and accepting their heritage, because, you know, a lot of people have issues with being able to match that genetically because they have these ideas that you have to look a certain way in order to be classified as indigenous or be classified as native, you know, so they really take to heart looking overly European or looking, you know, more Afrocentric. And it's important that people really understand what being a Taíno is, you know, that quintessential idea of what a native looks like. It doesn't exist for us at this in particular point. You know, we've gone through hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years of survival, literally surviving between genocide, murder, you know, rape, enslavement. We have had to survive through those, and in turn, some of our intermixing was forced, and some of it was just to continue the population. So it's important not to weigh heavy the ideas of what you look like and if it's valid enough to be reminiscent of what a Taíno is, you know. Being Taíno is in the spirit, it's in the culture, it's in the understanding of the basic of who we are as a people, as groups of individuals who are forming Yukayiks and, you know, really delving into that that cultural identity, not the physicality of what we are. You can wear regalia and look, you know, however you want to look, you know, you can put on face paint, but those things don't make you a Taíno. You know, it's how you really carry yourself. The Taínos were considered to be those noble people. So walking around with that humility and that nobility and being able to honor what you come from and really educate yourself on Taíno heritage and culture, that's what's going to make you the Taíno that you're looking to resonate with.
Right, right. That's beautiful. It's true. But, you know, with all these, you know, it's funny. I look at the Northern American native and also the South American native. You know, they're going through a transformation where we went through, say, 300 years ago with the intermarriages between different cultures.
Mm-hmm.
And I know it's been a clash for many people on that. You know, like traditional natives may not like that, or some more, you know, contemporary natives are like, you know, are changing. They're adapting to that environment. Many are leaving the reservation and going to, you know, nearby towns and cities. And they're, you know, they're falling in love with people from different cultures. What do you think about that? Is there, like I hear the conflict from people, from the natives, like, oh, we can't do that. We got to keep the blood pure. And so it's like a clash between blood and culture, right? So.
Right. Yeah, no, I definitely understand that. I mean, I understand the perspective, you know, from the outside looking in. I can understand why a tribe would want to try and keep their bloodline as indigenously pure as possible. You know, a lot of the reservations are reliant on that blood quantum, having a community that is able to prove a certain percentage of indigenous heritage, you know, in regards to the tribes that are there so that they can continue to retain their land. And again, that's one of the biggest issues with blood quantum in general. Once we no longer have a quantified amount of blood that fits the parameters of the requirements, what happens to the land? The U.S. government is more than likely going to swoop on in and say, you know what, you don't have anybody to occupy it anymore, so now it's mine. And whether it's fear of losing that ancestral land, and that being their driving cause for wanting to retain their bloodline, or if it's really the preservation of the culture that they're trying to do that for, I understand it. You know, I respect it. However, in the same capacity, we also have to understand that our ancestors wouldn't have wanted us to not mix with other tribes or other people for that matter. You know, we have a history of intertribal marriages that still carry indigenous bloodlines, and then it lays claims to two separate, you know, areas or reservations that, you know, they are able to inhabit and have records of being part of so that they can retain that land. But now, you know, we've lost so many indigenous groups that it's gotten to a point where, you know, people want to leave the res and they want to see what's not on the res. You know, they want to go out there and explore while still being true to their culture. And then sometimes they just so happen to fall in love with somebody that's not part of the culture. You know, I've seen people who were indigenous North American, indigenous Canadian, you know, indigenous Crow, indigenous Mohawk, and you know, they find a Pakistani person that they end up falling in love with, or a West African, you know, or even Taino, you know. So you can't be mad at them for exploring and accidentally falling in love, you know. So I support it. However, I do understand the claim and the worry behind wanting to keep claim to the culture and the land. And if anything, I think that Taino people resonate with those feelings the most, because we never had the opportunity to do that. You know, when Columbus came, we went from this substantial number of people in 1491 to a decimated population of less than, what, 1,500 people by 1511? So,
yeah, according to their records, yeah. According to their records, yeah.
Right. So according to their census records, you know, they could only find 1,500 of us to document. But, you know, we know that we had people who were in the mountains and in the caves and, you know, doing their best to survive and maintain the Taino culture. But that's what I'm from. Those numbers and those ideas, right, we could have tried and we did try to preserve our culture as much as possible. However, a lot of that was out of our control because of the way our women were treated, you know, and
exactly.
It forced us into where we are now. And it's an amazing fact that the Tainos have been able to still have such large percentages in modern Tainos, according to DNA. We have modern Tainos walking around today with 20-something percent of indigenous DNA from Puerto Rico specifically. You know, we still have genetic markers of indigenous Haiti and Dominican Republic today. You know, we still have genetic markers that prove indigenous Cuban descent. So the fact that we've been able to carry over such a substantial amount of DNA through all of the tragedy that we've experienced, I don't see a place for us to not be understanding of other tribes choosing to mix and intermingle. But again, I also, because of that, understand why you would want to try and retain that as much as possible. You know, we have to have smaller pieces of DNA, and within a generation or two, it may not show up on their, you know, in their children or grandchildren's DNA at all, that they were genetically related to the Taino people. So I get it. I do, which is why I personally
right.
feel so dedicated to the idea of that one drop rule. You know you come from Taino family, if you know you come from Taino culture, if your family's proven to you that they come from this and you don't have any of it in you, you're still Taino because your bloodline comes from it. It just happened to dwindle down when it got to you. But that heritage, that culture, that education that you grew up in, it's still yours in every capacity.
That's true. You know, you see a lot of people that travel to the Caribbean and oh, this Hispanic food, you know, Hispanic diet. They're always saying that, you know. And, hey, what about, you know, that same diet they're talking about is rooted in indigenous foods, right? The yuca, batata, yautía, quinepa, all that. That's from our ancestors. So why do they say it's Hispanic food, you know, it's a Hispanic diet?
Mm-hmm.
That's the indigenous, right? So for that to exist, to modern times now where you can go into a store, a bodega, a supermarket, and still get your yuca like that, and Caribbean folks are buying it like crazy, you know, that's a miracle, right? Compare what the historians are saying.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a miracle that DNA is alive and well, and the culture that was, what's that word, can't think of that word now. It starts with a T. Transmission of culture, right?
Exactly.
Plant medicines and all that. Yeah, plant medicines. It all points there,
The plant medicine, even the language. I mean, look at how many words have transferred over from traditional Taino words that are still being used today. You know, traditional Taino practices that are still being used today. Just conventional ideas. I mean, we had kunukus back in the day. We got bodegas now.
Mm-hmm. Well, no
it's
doubt.
Your backyard way to go get food and, you know, mix and mingle with your people and hang out. You trade. Originally, that's how bodegas worked. You would trade when you went into the bodega. You would trade with them. Or, you know, they had that little book. The book where they would write down what you owe and you come back and you pay it when you can, or you trade with them in lieu of payment. And I mean, that's how we did our kunukus. You know, it was an
that's
area
cool.
where we all got together, we farmed and we traded. So I mean, we have cultural practices that have carried over. They just are modernized. So the scrutinization
mm-hmm.
that a lot of Tainos get for not being these 1491 Tainos and actually becoming modern, it's so ridiculous. because, you know, over time, everything becomes modernized. We are in different spaces and different times. And the reality of it is, if the population of Taínos was still was as large then or now as it was then, there is no doubt in my mind that they would have evolved in the same sense that we've evolved now. Their technology would have evolved because they already had advanced technology on the island when they were there prior to Columbus. So the false idea of not allowing a modern Taíno to continue to evolve in their culture, it's disheartening, because our people wouldn't have done that. Our people would have definitely moved along and continued to make numerous advancements within who they were and their societies and their Yukayeks.
Yeah, definitely. You know, back when I was with the Taíno Nation, we used to play a joke, like pranks and stuff, but well, I won't say pranks. They were more like, I don't know. I don't know what to describe it, but some of us.
If you were doing them, they were probably pranks.
Right. You know, whenever we did gatherings, we were always like, all right, how do you know that guy's Taíno? How do you know she's Taíno? Like new members, you know, and then we always made a joke. There's only one way we can know how many gifts they can give away. And it was so true, man. Whenever we got together, there was always a competition. Hey, look what I made, you know, this and that. And it's like, here, take it, you know. And we were always, like, giving each other stuff, you know. And then
man,
people that showed
like
up. Huh? Yeah. There you go, man. Whenever you get natives together, they always want to give you something, you know. And
that's,
I tell you, we used to make those jokes, you know. You say, oh, that guy's not Taíno. He's like,
say all that.
And then,
Who's
that?
I said, I bendito.
Yeah, so we used to, that's how we tested people back in the day before DNA, how generous the person was. You know, it was interesting. And I know even now, you know, we talk about it, how we go to people's homes and it's like, you know, you leave a whole bag full of gifts, you know. And it's like, That's it, man. That's our culture. That's that indigenous culture. We want to give hospitality. You know, that's DNA, right? That's living DNA right there, the culture, the customs.
It only is.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know what? Let me see if you relate to this. When I first met Erwin Singsgestur, the Crow elder that taught in the Sweat Lodge, when I first met him, they gave me an address. And, you know, we GP'd. I said, we went over there. And the first thing after he greeted us, he said, listen, I apologize. Park your car here, and I'm going to take you somewhere else. And I'm like, all right, cool. So before we got out in his car, in his truck, he was telling us, you know, it's our tradition that we have to feed you, you know, but you know, we're elderly and, you know, my wife can't cook anymore and this and that well. So we're going to take you out to eat. And I'm like, oh, man, you know, we're all happy, you know, my wife and I. So they did it, took us out to eat. They said that's their tradition. When you're a guest, you got to feed you, you know. Whoever comes to the house, you got to be fed. And they felt bad, you know, they couldn't feed us.
That's definitely so, my family. I will say that,
so,
you know.
So I'm like, wait a minute. Are we in the Caribbean or what? I, you know.
Exactly. Exactly. I think that's a really big thing amongst the Caribbean people in general. A lot of cultures, at least for my family, I know, my Puerto Rican side, the side that celebrates being Taíno, we can't go to somebody's house without bringing something for that house. So when we go, like, if we visit our family, when I go to Puerto Rico, you know, I always go con un poquito de compra. And I'm just like, hey, here you go. I went to the store and I found these things and I bought them for you, you know, or I'll come with shirts, with gifts or something. When I go visit my aunts and my uncles here in the States, I always go with something. Like, if I know I'm going to be there, if I know I'm going to more than likely be eating food at their house because I know they're going to feed me, I always bring something to replenish what they're going to be offering me. And then when I'm leaving home or when I'm leaving to go back home, Dios santo, siempre con dos, tres, cuatro, cinco platos de comida. I mean, you saw it. You and I did an event together at the elementary school, and I tried to send you back onto the train to Brooklyn with a pan of food.
Word, man. I remember, and that's why I said, man, I'm back home. I'm home now. So we're family. We're family, right? That's what we did. We first met. Oh, this is family now.
Exactly.
Okay.
That was the first thing we said when we met. Like, yo, we probably related.
Word, man. You know what's funny? When I went to Nawake, right, during after Maria, I don't know if I said this story. Stop me if I did, but I think I did. But I think it's appropriate now. You know, a lot of those people, those elders up in the mountains in Comerio, they were living off food rations, you know. So they were getting, like, bags of rice. They were getting a lot of salchicha and all that. They were getting, like, a lot of canned food, you know. So and ham. Oh, cooked ham. They were getting a lot of that in cans, Spam and stuff like that. So I remember this abuelita, one of the grandmother council, she made all this food for us, and it was all from this ration food. And she apologized. She said, this is not what I normally cook, but I want you guys to eat. You know what I mean? That was very important for her.
Abuela.
I mean, I love the food. What she cooked, I was like, yo, this ain't ration food. This is, like, good stuff. The way she cooked it, it was like, my God, it was like she made the best of it. And that made me really emotional because it was like, wow, look at that. She's looking out for us. And this is all that, like, you know, this ration food is, you know, they give you just enough, you know, for
mm-hmm.
a couple of days. And there she cooked for us. And that I found was amazing. It's like, wow,
that
this
definitely
is it, man. Right? Abuela,
exactly.
Right?
Yeah, well, I always make sure everybody is good. It doesn't matter what's going on. It doesn't matter how much you have or how little you have. The abuelas always make it happen. My grandmother will always give me stories about her mother, you know, and they had a family, I believe, of 8 children, and it was just her and her husband with her 8 kids, and her husband worked and she didn't. So, you know, she took care of the property. They had their chickens. They had their little garden, their own little kunuku. And everybody knew that if they were hungry or they didn't have food or they didn't have enough food, when it was time to leave work, Doña Toña had food waiting. You know, so everybody from the barrio would be able to come down to the house if they needed food, if they didn't have food, just to get a plate from her. You know, whenever they were sick, they would always go, Doña Toña, to come and, you know, help heal them, to give them herbal remedies, to be the abuela to them. You know, she really cared for everybody in el barrio. And she was that person that everybody just adored so much. And then my grandmother moved to the States, and she started to do the same thing. You know, the kids on the block that needed to have food because whatever was going on at home, they were at my house. And, you know, my grandmother was feeding them. Their parents would come, and they would cry and say, oh, my God, you know, thank you for being so gracious to my child. And, you know, that was something that my grandmother learned from her mother, and then she now has passed that down to my mother, and my mother passed that down to me. And that's just how we were. You know, that spirit of the Taino lives in us through that graciousness, through that caringness, through really trying to be helpful people, to be good people, to be sharing and kind and considerate in all capacities. So, you know, I definitely think it's definitely embedded in us, to say the least.
Yeah. No, definitely, man. I just, you know, and, you know, as you mentioned it before, a lot of our people have different colors, different shades. You know, some have blondish hair, brown hair, red hair, freckles, whatever. Trigueño, black, you know, dark, I should say. But the bottom line is that it's that whole generosity, right? That whole, once you're in the culture, that's it. You know, and I found that with the Crows or the Lakotas. You know, that whole
mm-hmm.
sense of humor, too, right? No one takes anything seriously, which I love. You know, when people get together, right? There's always pranks and stuff and joking. And
always pranks, always jokes.
Right? I mean, there's always the serious person, you know. but it's the music. Music, that's another thing, right? Music.
Always
that's
music
another.
And dancing and food.
Mm-hmm. Yep, that's it. So it's a fine line, you know. It's a fine line because I know a lot of people get threatened by the indigenous identity, people who identify as indigenous.
Mm-hmm.
I know the friction is there and, you know, and from different folks in your islands, it's a fine line, but guess what? But we're all, you know, take titles away, whatever. We're one people, you know, the culture's there. It's just a matter
mm-hmm.
of helping people realize that, right?
Yeah. Definitely.
Non-confrontational way. Yeah.
Exactly.
I know Yaretum, yeah. I know Yare used to tell us all the time that when they did the DNA results with National Geographic, people who are like, oh, I'm not Indian, you know. Yo no soy India, you know, whatever. Because they were testing the abuelas, you know. And many of them was starch Christians or Pentecostal, whatever, or Catholic. So they were like, no, this is who we are. We're Puerto Rican, this and that. And then when the results came out, they were like, whoa, what? You know, I always knew. You know, like the voice changed.
Oh, wow.
Like, she always used to say, oh, I always knew, yeah, because, you know, blah, blah, blah. And then that whole attitude changed once they get the DNA results. And some people had huge numbers, like 80%, you know, stuff like that, up in those mountains. Yeah, so it was like pretty powerful testimony of just DNA alone, just looking at the DNA.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, it's definitely an experience. I mean, I grew up with my grandfather saying, you know, yo soy indio. And I grew up with my grandmother saying, ay, cállate ya. You know, she had no belief
exactly.
in being indigenous at all. None whatsoever. And I convinced her to do the ancestry DNA test with me or with my mother. I asked them both to do it for me. And sure enough, lo and behold, she came out with indigenous Puerto Rican and a pretty substantial mm-hmm. number for what it's worth. And, you know, she's just like, ah, pues, yo lo veo, pero al fin del día, soy boricua, soy puertorriqueña, y eso es nada más, yo no soy indígena, yo no soy india. Okay, we left
wow.
it alone. We made a trip to Puerto Rico. I brought her to one of the Taino museums out there. And as soon as we walk into the museum, she starts seeing pictures of the Bate. She sees pictures of the Borgios. She sees pictures of the pottery, and she sees the pottery, and she sees the bowls and the cups and everything made out of the Higueras and out of the Cocos. And she sees a duo. And she's sitting here telling me the names of all of these things without having captions, without having a guide, without having anything or anyone there. And, of course, I know what they are because I've done my research in the culture. But she had no idea that she was identifying Taino artifacts, Taino relics, with Taino names and using them in their full capacity as the Tainos did well in the 1400s and before. So when I sat there and I told her, listen, I know what you're saying. I know what you're talking about because the things that you're calling it is what they're called. The names have never changed. That's what the Tainos used. And it wasn't until November 2020 that my grandmother was just like, holy crap. All right, well, maybe yo soy India. Maybe
wow,
I
look
am
at that.
So it's an amazing thing to be able to have this science of DNA that, you know, can really show us and paint pictures of our identity. Because if she didn't have that experience of physically seeing and learning these things, she would have more than likely went to her grave with the idea of never, ever, ever am I Indio, you know? And now here she is like, oh, okay, I get it. I understand now. And she's so, so supportive about everything that, you know, I've chosen to do for helping people reclaim their indigenous identity. And it also goes to show everybody you are never too old or too young to make a connection with your Taino indigenous heritage.
Yeah. Oh, sound check. Hello, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Oh, I just went blank for a second. No, I hear you, man. But you know what gets me up? You know what's kind of confusing for me? When I look at a lot of DNA charts, right? Either 23andMe or Ancestry.com, they always put the European DNA really high, you know, high percentage. And that kind of gets me a little upset because it doesn't give the whole story. For example, in my DNA profile in 23andMe, it tells me that in the 1700s, early 1700s, my indigenous relatives started mixing, right? And it wasn't with Spanish people. It wasn't with the Spanish, the Spaniards. It was with different, like the Jewish and Ashkenazi. I find a lot
Ashkenazi.
Of people have that. Yeah.
Yeah, I have that too.
Yeah, and there's a lot of, and actually I just got a brother. He just sent me his results. He's unable to talk right now. He's being a very loyal dad right now and a husband because they're asleep, so he can't get on. But I want to share. Hold on a second. I'm just looking at the report now. Hold on a second. Interesting. This is definitely a relative of mine because we have almost exact. Wow. It's my good old brother right here, Sean Garcia. He's one of the founders of Revolutionary Fitness up in East Harlem. And he just sent me his 23andMe. You might want to check this out. Let's see what we can
here.
Once again, they put the European in there because I guess these might estimate that that's the last migration that came upon his DNA, right? Like, that's the last people. And I see it's the Canary Islands, Spanish and Portuguese.
Oh.
I know the Portuguese, right? What happened?
No, I said, oh, wow.
See, I like to go in reverse. So I'm bringing the Spanish. Portuguese is the highest percentage. So most likely they came last. So probably in the 1800s they came into his DNA. Then you got the Ashkenazi Jewish, was definitely lesser. So they were probably the first ones that showed up in the Caribbean. And probably these are the Jewish people that were that escaped exile, right? Oh, escaped Houston in Spain, right? And
yeah.
They disguised as Catholics, right? And then we have, so you got the Western Asian and Northern African. That's very common, I find, as well. The Arab, the Egyptian. Oh, the Levantine, that's new. I haven't seen that one before. Oh,
yeah,
Egyptian,
I have that.
Definitely about Egyptian. Yeah, you have that too? Wow, look at that. Egyptian.
Yeah.
Northern African. See, my estimate, those are probably the first sailors that came over, right? The Arabic. The Arabic. The Moors, I should say, right? So this is it's lower percentages, so they're probably, wow, probably 1500s, no? Hold on a second. I'm looking at this other stuff. Well, there's the African. There's your slaves. The slaves that came probably around the 1700s. West African, Nigerian, Senegambian, Guinean, right? Nigerian? No, there's your Yoruba influence, right?
Mm-hmm.
Mostly West African. Those are your slaves. Those are your slaves that came over. And they most likely came over with this low percentage of, it says broadly European, 0.4%. So that's that. Those are probably those first Europeans that came. you know.
I think that's my biggest pet peeve with 23andMe, that they use the phrase broadly and then whatever region it is, and they use it for mine at least, they had so many of them, broadly this, broadly this, broadly this, broadly that.
Right.
And it agitated me so bad when I saw it.
Right. Now, for the recent ancestry in the Americas, it's interesting, the language they use, recent ancestry, they have them Caribbean and Ponce, Puerto Rico, Ponce, the West Coast, right, which a lot of us come from, and also Cuban, Havana, Cuba. And that's interesting because of Havana, Cuba, a lot of Boricuas, I find, have that connection to Cuba. So that's your migration that's coming from Central America. That's what I see.
Absolutely.
Because,
I have archaic.
I'm sorry, Central America. What's that?
I don't match with almost any Puerto Rican archaic DNA, but I match with a lot of Cuban archaic DNA.
Oh, man, see? Archaic DNA?
Yeah, archaic, ancient DNA.
Yeah, but that's the thing. And here, okay, here's the thing. They put European up high, like in Sean here. When you look at Sean, he's definitely, you know, phenotype is definitely of the, what do you call it, indigenous. But see, here's the thing. They put European high, but then we have all this archaic DNA, right, from the indigenous. How long do you think it took the indigenous peoples to migrate to Puerto Rico? Or Cuba, how long you think that took? Using the Clovis boy DNA.
Very true, because Clovis is ancient. It's very ancient. So is the Kenilworth
right.
man.
And people have written on this, the experts, that 90%, according to GetMatch, 90% of Caribbean indigenous folks that have Caribbean blood match Clovis. And Clovis died 11,500 years ago. So his relatives took him a while to get down there, right? So
exactly.
So if you compare European DNA, which maybe if you're lucky 300 years, right, of diluting the DNA, 200 years, 250 years, pair that to 12,000 years. And I know Dr. Ballar was talking about that, about that it dilutes, right? The DNA dilutes,
right?
The percentages, right?
Mm-hmm.
But the culture doesn't dilute. Maybe the DNA does, but what the culture, right? That's not diluting. That's getting stronger, better than ever now. So I'm
exactly.
just thinking
about and that's what's
right?
important. Not the drops of blood, not the percentages, not the features, the culture, how we honor that culture.
Because here's the thing. Okay, let's look at this. Okay, Spanish. Okay, I'm looking at Sean's overall. They have them first place, Spain and Portugal. Second place, indigenous American. Then they have the African, okay? But then you break down the culture. For example, how, you know, what's your mindset? What's your attitude? How you living your life? You know, I know Sean pretty well. He's very, you know, he's into the body health, body, mind, spirit. You know, owns a health, you know, health body, also spirit, martial arts. See, that's as indigenous as you can get, right? You know, medicine, the body, that's medicine. So it's the mindset, you know, it's our attitude. How do we live our life? It's indigenous, you know, it's still very much alive. It's my opinion.
No, I definitely agree with you. 100%. 100%. Lisa Suarez also just said here as well. So she's right there with you too.
And here's the thing. And a lot of people make this mistake that we look at the African as a foreigner, but the African is also indigenous. So that adds to the mix. You know what I
mean? Exactly. Everybody does overlook that. There are so many indigenous tribes in Africa, and a lot of us belong to them. I mean, me personally, you know, I have Yoruba, Mandinkin, and Sanaki, to just name a few that I have genetic ties to. So, I mean, you know, we have to really take into consideration that there is indigenous identity in a lot of the regions that we come from, even China. China also, Tibet, they also have indigenous communities as well. So, you know, the people who really start to make the choice to delve into these things really look into the culture outside of just your percentages. Always look into the culture, because you will find things that you innately resonate with that you may have never been able to pinpoint why these are things that you like or things that you partake in or things that you favor. And then you find out that you have a piece of that in you, and now it's just like, oh, shoot, it makes sense.
Yeah. You know what's cool? I once read hold on a second. I'm going to raise Sean. I want to thank Sean for sharing his DNA. But, you know, before I mention something, I'm looking at his – let's go through memory lane. Hey, Sean, we're definitely related, man. I got the same towns. Ponce, San Juan, Utuado, Mayagüez, Arecibo, Aguadilla, Lares. Grito de Lares, San Sebastián, Ayuya, and Yauco. So, you know, these are all Taíno hotspots. These are famous Yucayeques, man, right across.
Mm-hmm.
Utuado. You know, Ponce, we got to change that name. What's up with that, man? We got to change Aguabana, it should be called, not Ponce.
That's exactly what it should be called.
Aguabana, that was his territory, not...
That is. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of places in Ponce that have his sonnet and have his name on it. You know, when I went, I took a photo of the statue, and it's so sad because the statue was literally right on the corner by a little convenience market, just chilling there. Just, you know, nobody can sit there and really park a car to go and honor the statue that's there. But they have restaurants out there named after him. They have the area that he was thought to live in. They have that area, you know, well documented with signs and everything. And they definitely should change it from Ponce to his name.
Yeah. And you know, it's Sean just wrote me, he says, whack ass name. Yeah, I agree. That's right, man. You know, when the movement's gonna take off in Puerto Rico and the Caribbean in general is when we start taking these statues down. When we start taking these statues down, that's when the movement's gonna begin. And, right? When we start taking these as a collective. You know, historically
statue of Columbus and his stupid ship.
Arecibo, right?
Yeah. Yes. It burns my soul, because when you're driving through Arecibo, who has a history of having Taínos and so much rich Taíno history, and you can stop in the middle of the road and see that big, stupid Columbus statue, it's so distasteful. It's so disrespectful. It's such a slap in the face to continue to dishonor the indigenous people from the area.
Well, is that your DNA talking? Right?
It sounds like it, right?
Yeah. Well, you know, tourists love it. The tourism, they love that. And people, you know, who embrace the evangelization of the Americas, European expansion, you know, and all that, and the islands, you know, they love the statue. It represents wealth, progress. You know?
Yeah.
But for us, what does it represent, right?
And see, that's what matters. Tourists are going to come and they're going to go. Our people have to be the ones to continuously look at it. And I firmly believe that when we stop using and revering these colonizers' statues and images and histories, once we stop, romanticizing it, once we stop romanticizing it, I can almost guarantee you that the pride of the indigenous people of Puerto Rico specifically will come back in such a force. However,
yeah.
We will have some people who will always give pushback because they are quote-unquote traditionalists, but the majority, it'll start a whole new awakening of indigenous identity.
Definitely. Funny, Sean Rowe, let's get these statues down. That's the true revolution statue movement in Puerto Rico. And also, let's introduce people to our ways, our indigenous culture. Let's embrace that more than ever. You know, repatriations, as Sean mentioned, history. Oh, man, Sean, we got to talk about Arayeke. So, you know, what I was going to say, oh, you know, even historically, you know, Aguebana gave Ponce his name. You know, they had the name, the Guatao ceremony, to maintain peace and avoid war. And it worked. It worked before his death.
Well, the first,
this is what he
did.
Huh?
Aguebana, the first, is the one who gave Ponce
the elder.
His name. Mm-hmm.
Right.
And then his mom ended up taking the European name, Doña Inés.
Right. But my whole thing is, Ponce's name is Aguabana, technically. So Ponce should be named Aguabana, if you want to look at the history, right?
I agree wholeheartedly.
So it's a double-edged sword. They're dissing the indigenous, but they're also dissing history. They're forgetting history because they exchange names. So, wow. I forgot what I was going to say. I was going to say something about the I forgot. I just slipped my mind. You know, we get all excited, right? His DNA just pop. It starts to activate. You know, we like the, you know, there's an old cartoon. I want to age myself, like the Wonder Twins. You know, you ever heard of the Wonder Twins?
I know exactly who the Wonder Twins are. See, now I gotta get you a Wonder Twins ring, so we can put them together and unite.
That's it, man. When that DNA is activated, right? That's it. DNA activated. You know, I want to turn into this big warrior and pick up statue, you know, Columbus statue, right?
Oh, yeah, you're going to be Urayan?
We're all picking up. But I'll be, like, taller than the statue and just throw it in the ocean, right? And then,
yeah.
I don't know, man. So it's, yeah, this DNA is no joke, man. Hey, how about this? You ever get this experience? I know for me it's a big trigger. When I see a child get hit in public or whipped, you know, that's like a trigger for me, and I think it's part of the DNA. You know, as slaves, we were whipped, we were tortured.
I can't do it. My children, they're not disciplined like that. I barely even raise my voice at my children. I don't think that because of the way a child's mind works, it's not conducive to their development, and then it's habits that they develop growing up. You know, and that's how they choose to respond and react. Not to mention, we're supposed to be nurturing our children. So rather than having them fear us, they should feel love and compassion. So it's not a thing that I do. You know, it's not something that I believe in. And it's because I know genetically we have so much trauma embedded in us that our first nature is immediately, you know, show dominance. Show dominance because that's what was shown to us, you know, when we were forced to be enslaved. It was people having to prove their dominance over who we were and forcing us into submission. So I think just psychologically, I can't allow myself to sit in that idea of disciplining in that capacity. I can't do it. It makes me cringe.
Yeah, man, it's a trigger for me because it's just, you know what's another tradition? I don't know if it's in Dominican Republic, but definitely or Haiti, but in Puerto Rico, they still practice this in Borinquen around, I believe it's around Easter time or Holy Week. And I witnessed this, and I was with Yare. We were traveling around the mountains, And you see all these horses, and I forget what the tradition is called, but there's all these people on horses going up the mountain, you know, and traveling in the towns. And I say, Yare, yo, what is the special occasion, all these horses, you know? And then she starts to laugh. She says, oh, they're reenacting how the Spaniards were chasing the Indians in the mountains, the Taínos in the mountains.
What?
They say Los Indios. They do this every year. And people are loving it, you know. It's a whole drunk fest, too, afterwards. And they're honoring that tradition of the Spaniards chasing the Indians up the mountain, you know, chasing them down. So they have all these horses going up the mountain. And that's still a tradition that's like
oh,
tradition,
no,
you know. So statues are definitely first, but we also got to tear down that tradition somehow. You know,
yeah,
that's not
we
right.
Definitely have to work on that colonized mindset, that conditioning that they've been, you know, forced into living, because like a lot of it is learned over time because again of the stigmas, you know, people were afraid to consider themselves as Indio because they were persecuted for being indigenous. So you know, over time that turned from fear to now it's, you know, these ideas of, you know, Indio sucio or, you know, we're savage or, you know, all these negative connotations to describe what it is to be indigenous or to be Indio. And people have shied away from that idea because of the stigmas. So we really have to decolonize the mindset of people in general in the Caribbean who are less than enthusiastic about reclaiming their indigenous roots.
And you know what's crazy? Ponce de Leon, he made his reputation comes from Quisqueya. He was an Indian hunter, using our terms now, Indian killer. And that's what he did. He went up those mountains looking for as much Indians as possible, and he would kill them. Or our ancestors, I should say, Taino. And he would kill them. That's how he made his reputation. And he was so good at it that he became the governor of Borinquen. So as Sean said, we got to educate our people and repatriation. That's the key. Oh, I think we lost. Hold on. I can't hear you. I think we lost Stephanie. Let me see if my phone was lost. See, this happens sometimes. Sometimes Brick Brothers shuts us down. I think they shut down Stephanie. I can't hear you. Inaru Boria, can you hear me? No, I can't hear you. I think we lost you.
Oh,
hello?
There we go. Now you can hear me.
See, they try to censor you.
I don't know what
happened. You're back.
My phone. I could hear everything that you were saying, but there was nothing on my screen. It was so weird.
Nah, this is they're listening. Who are you know, the other people listening too? You know, that are they're kind of intimidated by all this stuff. So, but that's all right, man. You know, we're generous. We'll give you a gift too. It's called we're all one. We pass the good smokes, you know, and hey, we're all friends, you know. We don't have to hurt each other.
Oh man,
you know?
Good
no,
smoke.
No censoring, you know. We're one people, man. Homo sapien tribe, right? Oh, I see. Sean also has some Neanderthal. I can't pronounce that word. Neanderthal blood.
Neanderthal. Me too. I have 2% Neanderthal in me.
2% is pretty high. That's like halfway point, you know.
Yeah, that's what they said. That it's pretty not common to have a percentage of 2%. But I got 2% in there.
Well, you know, Neanderthal, they got kind of bullied around by the Homo sapiens, so I kind of relate to the Neanderthal, right? As indigenous peoples, right? We can relate to the Neanderthal, so it's kind of cool. We got their blood.
Yeah,
their DNA
definitely is. It's really cool that it's been able to travel for this long.
Definitely. I know they would say, bring down the statues. That's it, man. Bring them down. We got a lot of work to do. But it seems like with all these DNA profiles, when we invite people in the future to, you know, send it to us or call in and share your results. Why? Because it shows that we're more alike than different, right? We're more alike than different. If you identify as indigenous or Afro-indigenous or whatever indigenous, that's it, man. We're all one family. And that's the key. You know, we're going to argue, right? Like any good family, we're going to argue and disagree. But we just have to make it work somehow. Right?
Exactly. We all come together at the end of the day. It's all love at the end of the day.
Yeah. I'm trying to look for a song. We only have, like, how many minutes we have left? Oh, damn. We have 4 minutes left. So you know what? I kind of burned this song, kind of played it out. But I think it's appropriate. Which one? That's the Juan Luis Guerra. You know, he was criticized for that album, Arreto. A lot of his people and people who knows his music, they kind of criticized him, like, what you doing? You're not going to make money off that album. And he dedicated to the Taino. And I'm trying to look for it now. Oh, yeah, Daka. Well, Naboria, Daka, Mayani, Makana. Basically, he's saying, you know, we're indigenous. You know, we're from the land. Please do not kill us. That's the lyrics throughout the whole song. Please do not kill us. But guess what? They didn't kill us. We're still here. But 1992, when people were celebrating Christopher Columbus and the whole discovery, Juan Luis Guerra released this beautiful album called Arreto. Stephanie, there?
Yes, I'm here, Sana Cody.
Oh, okay, no problem, man. So I'm going to end the show with this. Naboria taka mayani makana, yo soy taino, no me mate. Do not kill me. So any last words before I put the song?
Well, it's just for the listeners, thank you for sharing space with us tonight. I hope that your reintroduction to the DNA show today was everything you anticipated. And I look forward to the next show, and hopefully we can go over another one of our listeners' DNA, and maybe I'll throw my DNA in there one of these days, too.
Oh, that's awesome, man. So here it is. Thank you all for listening. Thank you, Sean, for sharing your DNA profile.
Yes,
next time we got to get
Sean.
You on the show. Yeah. Here we go. Naboria daka mayani makana. I am the servant. I am the indigenous of the land. Please do not kill us.
Naboria daka huaitia, mayane makana. Naboria daka.